So I'm going to start by the TV here with motivation. I don't want to be scribbling all the motivation on the blackboard. So why should you care about scattering involving gravity? I'd say there's three big reasons. Number one is just understanding conserved quantities in general relativity. I think that's intrinsically interesting and helps us all process what's going on with the theory. Number two, quantum gravity certainly has to involve scattering in some way. It may be fundamental. There may not be local observables in quantum gravity. There may only be, you know, scattering type things you can compute. You want to understand the symmetries of the S matrix, and, you know, Strominger in 2014 brought the classical GR asymptotics program back towards the symmetries of S matrix program, and that's very much on my mind in continuing. And where I actually got into this is so-called applications, other calculations, but, you know, I got into post-Minkowski scattering, meaning weak field scattering between two masses with large impact parameter, and I computed some angular momenta, and it didn't agree with what other people computed, and other groups are still getting different things a couple years on. And I realized that if I was going to assert, you know, either we were right or they were right or we're both right or whatever, I needed to actually know what angular momentum is in general relativity. And I went to the literature and I found a lot of stuff about null infinity and not very much at all about defining angular momentum of like incoming masses like black holes or stars. And we had to invent it for ourselves. Now, not invent from scratch. Absolutely not, but very much take a long history of work on asymptotics in general relativity and generalize it as necessary for the problems of interest and then kind of stitch everything together. So on the one hand, it's a very small step. On the other hand, the paper has 400 equations. It was a lot of work and a lot had to be done. So what I'm actually going to talk about today, first of all, classical. Quantum is in the back of my mind, but we're going to understand the classical case first. So I mean classical scattering of m incoming bodies and n outgoing bodies. So these could be black holes, neutron stars, finite-sized bodies. Definitely not point particles. Finite. Sized bodies in four-dimensional general relativity. So that's where I want to start. And I, for the motivation listed on the screen, which I'll leave up in case you forget, I really want a whole framework that says exactly what things are like angular momentum. I want to know that angular momentum is conserved as some kind of theorem, not just an expectation. And I want to know in mathematical detail how those things are defined and in what sense they are conserved, so that in particular, I can apply it to the puzzles in angular momentum and scattering, and then more generally just understand asymptotics in GR. So cartoons to keep in mind, examples of this, here's what we would write for 2-to-2 scattering. So we would have a incoming black hole or neutron star that would scatter, and we'd have another one down here would come in and scatter a little bit. So this would be scattering angle 2. This would be scattering angle 1. There's no reason they have to be the same. They are the same in low orders in many analytic calculations. But in principle, they could be different. There'd be some radiation that would come out. Some gravitational wave detectors might observe it. Maybe LIGO, you know, just in theory anyway. So you want to know about the radiation. You want to know about the bodies. So this might be a black hole or a neutron star. Maybe this is some other kind of star. And usually when people talk about these calculations, they think about the observables as something like impact parameter, as scattering angle as a function of impact parameter. So I'll draw on the cartoon B as some impact parameter. And the cartoon is all well and good. And if we were scattering in a fixed two-dimensional blackboard, this would be a perfectly good definition of impact parameter. You just, you know, take your ruler out and measure how much higher this line is than that line. But in general relativity, it might be more subtle How would you even define impact parameter? Well, it has to do with the angular momentum. That's the only way I can think of as defining it. It would be something like B is the orbital angular momentum over the momentum in some center of momentum frame, for example. And now, even though you thought you were innocently just setting up the scattering problem of some bodies, you actually need to understand angular momentum in general relativity. So it's not some esoteric thing that you can ignore. If you want to be able to talk to your friends and tell them how you defined B, and you want to be able to do that without some preferred background structure, not in some just in full general relativity, asymptotically flat general relativity, you need a framework right at the beginning. And then you want to say what LIGO would observe, what the final spin of these bodies would be, and so on, and you have to have definitions. And I claim that before our work, such definitions didn't really exist in enough generality. So let me summarize the situation. And I was going to give one other cartoon. Could also have 2-to-1 scattering. That would be a merger. So that would be something like this. Okay, so that could happen too. That counts as scattering. The only thing I'm going to assume is that the bodies are asymptotically free, I guess, although it's not so simple in GR. But I'll make very precise what I mean by the bodies are coming in from infinity. So this is 2 come in and 1 goes out, but it could be in general m goes to n. All right. So I'm going to cover up this TV and mostly refer to that TV. Try not to pinch myself. So I'm going to keep on here the motivation and a diagram I'm going to draw over here, which I'm never going to refer to again. The diagram I'm going to draw is a conformal diagram. Now, conformal diagrams are very nice for some things, but I don't think they're very nice for this kind of scattering. And I'm going to try to convince you of that as part of the talk, or at least show you why a different diagram is helpful. But in terms of the state of the art, the way this process 2-to-1 or 2-to-2 would be represented is you would have some conformal diagram of flat space-time. And so this would be scry minus. This would be scry plus, and then we would have I zero, and this would be I plus, and this would be I minus. Okay, how many of you are familiar with this terminology in this diagram? Amazing. Okay. All right. So this is normally how you would represent flat space-time. It's great for understanding the causal structure of flat space-time. But for scattering, it's a little hard to represent everything. There's a few things that I don't particularly like. Number one is the initial state of the bodies needs to live here. These are massive bodies at past time like infinity. There's not really a lot of room to show the different possibilities, right? There, somehow everything has to come out. A scattering thing, they would like come out and then maybe merge together and then go into 1, that would be like 2-to-1. So you can do it, but there's not a lot of room. The other thing that I find a little frustrating about this diagram is the fact that scry plus is screaming towards the source at the speed of light. That really seems a little weird to me. This null scry is forced upon you if you want to define the boundary of your space-time as a conformal boundary, which has a lot of utility for some questions. But there's no imperative in understanding scattering to have your place where detectors live some kind of conformal boundary, OK? I mean, so, you know, the LIGO detectors or something start to look like scry on this diagram. You know, they're sort of looking like this. You know, this is a time-like trajectory where LIGO could live, and it sort of looks like scry. But that's a artifact of the way scry is defined. So I'm not going to spend my whole time trying to explain why this diagram is misleading, in my opinion. I just want to emphasize the differences. And I'll give you guys a chance to ask a question about it in a minute. But the diagram that we found more helpful is going to be more like this. So we're still going to have kind of r equals 0. I'm going to draw it nice and big so I can refer to it. As I'll argue, and I'm not the first to say this, time-like infinity naturally really has the structure of a hyperboloid. So I'll explain that, but first let me draw it. Oops, I drew it upside down. Shows how well I know my own work. Okay. So a time-like structure of a hyperboloid will kind of look like that. Future time-like similarly. So the two-sphere is suppressed, so you can think of it as a hyperboloid of rotation. Then for null infinity, I'm going to draw it as a vertical line, so it looks more time-like. That's where the LIGO detectors are. They're not moving inwards in any sense. And so the diagram I'm going to use here is future time-like infinity, future null infinity, past null infinity. Spatial infinity is the other kind of hyperboloid, past time-like infinity. So to orient you, the picture is going to be incoming bodies come in, something like this. There's some interaction region, and incoming bodies go out, in this case, 2-to-1. Radiation goes out to scry. I'm assuming no incoming radiation, although there's nothing in the framework that would forbid that. And this is the picture I'm going to use, and hopefully in the course of the 30 minutes, 40 minutes, I will explain every piece and make it seem reasonable and show you the mathematics. Did you have a question?
Just like these corners, how do I think about this from Scribe Plus?
Scribe Plus or I Plus?
So the corner that joins
that. Ah, the corner.
Yeah.
You have to think of it as a limit, and that'll be part of the talk. So let me get there. So the general philosophy, there's a good chance for me to say that. So over here on the previous work, a second question. How many of you have heard of supertranslations? Okay. How many of you are like comfortable, have a decent understanding of supertranslations? Okay. All right. Excellent. If I tried to give a first principles treatment of supertranslations, it might be interesting, but I wouldn't talk at all about my own work. So for those of you who don't know much about them, I'm just going to say that the asymptotic symmetry group of Scry Plus is the BMS group. So BMS group, since everyone has heard of this, I'll just say the words. Initially, people thought, well, flat spacetime has the Poincaré group. Asymptotically, flat spacetime would have an asymptotic symmetry group of Poincaré. The big surprise of Bondi and collaborators was that there's more than just the Poincaré freedom. There's these supertranslations, which are in addition to the Poincaré freedom, that are just as valid. If you ask, you know, what coordinate transformations do I have that preserve the asymptotically flat nature of the metric, according to many different reasonable definitions, all roads lead to this BMS group. You have these supertranslations. And so, you know, there's a BMS group here, and there's a BMS group here as well, by time reversal, basically. And starting with work of various people, but Ashtekar and Strominger, I think, are the people who really pushed it. There's identifications across I0, but there's only been really one paper with a BMS group at I0, and there's been almost nothing at I plus and I minus. So the sort of state of the art is that we have this diagram, we have different versions of these five infinities, and what we want to do, so the goal is, number one, we want to show that we want to get BMS at all five infinities. We're going to need I plus minus and I0. So by get BMS, I mean establish a framework where the symmetries of these match the ones at null infinity. And then number two, stitch everything together. Stitch infinities together. So we just have one BMS group, not five. Right, in the same way you would say that scattering in flat space-time is governed by the Poincaré group, different people could work in different frames, they'd get answers for different answers for, say, angular momentum, but we all know how angular momentum transforms under translations, and we're all happy. In general relativity, we need to do something like that for the group of symmetry group we have, which is the BMS group, and so that's the program of the talk. Okay, that was my best effort to explain to this crowd. So, questions now on the whole strategy, why I'm doing this, anything. You're on board? Okay. All right, so my plan is to do time-like infinity in some detail, since that's the most new. We had to do the most extra work at time-like infinity to get us a BMS group where we could talk about, you know, angular momentum and so on, as I argued we needed to. And then hit the highlights of null infinity, and then tell you about how we match them together at this corner, which you think of as a kind of overlapping limit. So both far from all the bodies at time-like infinity and late times at null infinity.
You have a sense of, you know, given that this framework was missing before, people still, you know, talked about the angular momentum that I minus and I plus, so.
Yeah, myself included.
I presume that invoked a lot of, you know, choices and arbitrary things.
Yeah, you just work in some coordinate system and the bodies have locations, x of t, and you compute r cross p and call that angular momentum. And, you know, the trouble is the change in r cross p doesn't match the radiated angular momentum when you look at the time-space components, in particular, already at very low orders in the post-Minkowski expansion. So I think it's totally respectable to proceed as if those naive definitions are fine until something goes wrong. But now something really has gone wrong. And this framework is the only way I can think of to, or something similar is the only way I can think of to start sorting that out.
And to what extent, so when you face that situation where you're, you know, your proposal for angular momentum doesn't satisfy a balance law, you can always go back and modify. I mean, were there attempts to ad hoc modify?
I haven't seen actually any balance laws for angular momentum derived. I've seen them derived on Scry. Sure. Going back many, many years, of course, you can have a local flux of angular momentum, and you can have an angular momentum that depends on you. But in terms of something that would say final angular momentum in the bodies, you know, minus flux of angular momentum equals initial angular momentum, I actually haven't seen that. I think ours is the first. Yeah, and that's what I want, Mikino. Go ahead.
So I don't claim to have the best understanding on this kind of stuff, but I know I've done some reading on quasi-local mass energy measures in GR.
I don't know much about those either.
There's a ton of them. There's like so many of them, and you know, there's the most popular ones that people use. But the one thing that's repeated is there's no local definition of mass energy, and I would expect there to be a similar thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, by the equivalence principle, you can always coordinate transform away the first derivative of the metric, which is what you'd expect to where you'd expect to find gravitational energy if there were one. So I think everyone can agree there's no local definition. Quasi-local, I think the idea is to pick some surface in a general space-time and talk about how much is in that. Here I'm going to restrict to a class of space-times. I'm going to make a lot of assumptions, and you feel free to question them, and my claim is all those assumptions are appropriate for considering cartoons like this, smashing things together where they, you know, N bodies coming in, N bodies coming out, in a sense where far in the past, far away from the scattering event, space-time is very approximately flat. And that's going to, I'm going to give a definition of scattering space-times and give you a framework for those space-times. So let me show you time-like infinity. It's pretty cute. I didn't invent this, but we added some words to it that really helped. And then we generalized it fully to get the definitions we need. So let's just think about the first thing you might think about for I plus, time-like infinity. You'd probably imagine just, you know, working in some Cartesian coordinates and then letting t to infinity. It's sort of what people often think and sometimes say about time-like infinity. But this is not very good for scattering because unless your body has zero velocity, it won't have a limit, right? If you have a body which has like, you know, I don't know, x equals vxt or something. If you take t to infinity, well, x goes to infinity. And so your body that you're trying to define the charges for, like angular momentum and so on, doesn't even have a finite limit. So body has no limit in this approach. So this is not what you want to do to define time-like infinity. You want the bodies to intersect time-like infinity so you can say, okay, that body has so much energy, so much momentum as a property or something defined on time-like infinity. So we don't want to do this. What do you want to do? Well, if we want to keep the bodies in our metric, in the limit, what we need to do is we need different coordinates where the coordinates are constant on each body. So introduce new coordinates that are constant on outgoing bodies. Let me show you an example to make this and the one we use. Let's imagine we're just in flat space-time. And let's pick an origin. And let's just imagine a sort of swarm of a light cone filled up with bodies of different velocities. And let's think about how we could label them. Well, we could talk about the velocity of each one. But then our coordinates would run from like -1 to 1 or 0 to 1, and that would be kind of annoying. So the nicer thing is to look at the rapidity. So what's the rapidity of one of these world lines? So that's, you know, arctan of v. So it's just, you know, v goes from, well, I guess, 0 to 1 in this case, and the rapidity goes from 0 to infinity, right? It just gives you a nice range. So let's call the rapidity rho. And for this fiducial swarm of bodies we're trying to understand, what is the magnitude of the velocity? Well, these are coming from the origin, so it's just going to be r over t. That wrote t. R over t. Okay, so I'm introducing a new coordinate. And when you pick a value of rho, it's constant on one of these different curves, these straight line motion bodies in flat space time, and it is equal to the rapidity of that body. So I'm choosing coordinates that label the speed of the particles. Okay, because that way, if I take the limit to late times fixing this rho, I can't lose the particle. It can't run off to infinity because it's got rho equals constant on it. Sorry, late tau, yeah. It's got rho equals constant on it, so I can't lose the body. Does that make sense? Yeah. Oh. So, I mean, we didn't introduce these coordinates. It goes back to Weigand-Schmidt working at spatial infinity, and there was some recent work by some others doing similar things at time-like infinity as well. But this is the motivating physical idea that's going to lead us to this hyperboloid. So we need a time coordinate. You might be able to get away with t, but it's more natural to use something a little more invariant. So proper time, right? So what is proper time? Well, in this case, it'll be t squared minus r squared for these radially moving particles. Okay. So now I have coordinates. I've got rho, tau, theta phi. I'm still in flat space time. What is the metric? Ends up being, just make the coordinate transformation here. It ends up being minus d tau squared plus rho squared d rho squared plus sinh squared rho d omega squared. This is the Milne universe, the hyperbolic slicing of Minkowski space-time. This metric here, make sure I got this right. Yeah, it looks right. This metric here is, you can think, we call it the hyperboloid metric. It's also Euclidean ADS. None of this matters if you don't know what it is. If you do, make some connection perhaps. So we can think of it as the tau equals constant surfaces look like this. For tau greater than 0, there's this sort of fiducial light cone that I picked in constructing this. But when you write Minkowski space in these coordinates, this is what you get. So the idea is, oh, this should say tau. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just
going to say something. Yeah, please blurt it out. Okay, now it makes sense. So the idea is that this is truly flat space-time, but if we have a behavior like this at large tau, that would be an asymptotically flat space-time. Okay, so we're going to say a space-time is asymptotically flat, if there exist coordinates, call them tau, rho, theta, phi, such that ds squared goes to this as tau goes to infinity. Now that's not yet a complete definition. I need to give you lots of conditions, but that's the gist of it. And that's why we draw I plus as a hyperboloid. What's going on here is that as tau gets later and later, you're moving to sort of larger and larger hyperboloids as tau gets later and later. But this thing here, which is going to become I plus itself, this is the unit Euclidean ADS3, right? We're ignoring this tau squared. This is what we're going to call I plus. And so you're kind of, if you like, multiplying by tau to the minus 2 and getting a unit hyperboloid. Okay, and so that's why we draw it as a hyperboloid, and the trajectories that land on it are the outgoing velocities of the particles. Okay? All right. So now to take this from an idea to an actual framework, there's a huge amount of detail. You have to, you know, say precise assumptions about exactly how it approaches infinity, what's allowed, and so on. We imported a lot of that from work done already at spatial infinity because there's acute analytic continuation that you can perform just to take formulas from here and make them valid here. I'm not going to go over the derivation anyway, but let me show you what the assumptions are. Oh, wow, this is long. Oh, I see. It's covering up the... Let's leave the TV. Okay. Good. So let me show you. So here's what we're actually going to assume. Minus 1 plus 2 sigma over tau plus sigma squared over tau squared plus higher order terms plus tau squared HAB, that's what we're going to call this thing. This is what I mean by HAB, that metric on a hyperboloid in flat space-time. So that's encoding asymptotically flat. And the way this is written is 1 over tau, something called KAB minus sigma HAB with a factor of 2. And then, unfortunately, you need log terms to be compatible with all known results. That was a major headache. There's a log tau over tau squared times some IAB plus a 1 over tau squared times some JAB plus higher order terms. So think of this as just magic. It's been justified. This is a good form to assume. It's compatible with every space-time that we know of that would resemble scattering. And there's a very nice framework associated with it. So you can see flat space-time is here, minus 1 plus tau squared HAB. That's what we had here, minus 1, tau squared HAB. And then we have some corrections. So the first correction, this is our tau goes to infinity limit. So the first correction here is called sigma. Well, let's start with HAB. Oh, yeah. I need a D phi A. Yeah, both of them are missing the line element. Thanks. Details. Okay, excellent. And again, and then phi A is the collection. Yes, so that you can remove those by a gauge transformation. This is the Beig-Schmidt expansion after their work at spatial infinity.
surprising thing for me is that the fall off behavior there and there should mimic each other. I don't see a reason why they should.
Where's there and there? You mean on this diagram?
Or? Zero versus I plus.
Oh yeah, I don't know. It's a weird analytic continuate. You like have to shift by I pi over two. There's weird stuff in relating them, but at I plus you go to large row. Think of it this way. Think about it this way. This is the space of space-like velocities, and this is the space of time-like asymptotic velocities. So now they sound more similar.
Yeah, but I mean, it must reflect some assumption about how fast you can approach.
Well, we're making the same set of assumptions at I zero as I plus. You can think of it that way.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I'm wondering why that necessarily has to be.
All I know is we can write them down, we get a very nice framework, and they're compatible with what I have seen in the literature on scattering in terms of actual. And there's a lot of stuff that isn't compatible, like the Hawking-Perry-Strominger papers, where they talked about matching across here, made some assumptions about, you know, angular momentum aspect actually aren't true. you know, and maybe we made some assumptions that will be proven untrue later, but I think the basic approach is sound and, you know, the details of what we assume and why, I'm just not going to be able to get into in the talk.
There's no log terms in the detail square.
Yeah, you can put them there if you want, but then, yeah, we didn't need them, yeah.
When you say you don't need them, is that a certain initial condition?
Yeah, we make a bunch of assumptions at, I mean, we have in mind this scattering type problem. And so you can look at, like, there's a paper by Sahu and Sen called, like, Soft Graviton Theorem Rewritten. I don't really understand the connection to Soft Graviton Theorem, but they do give a very general solution for what the field should look like around here. And so by taking their assumptions and building it in this framework, you can actually prove that that log term is non-zero in general. And it didn't force anything here. So all I can say is the assumptions we made are consistent with what we know about we personally know about scattering, which I think is equivalent to what the field knows, but might not be. Okay, so I was just going to sort of point out the field on I plus. So just to be clear, I plus itself is the space spanned by these coordinates. Okay. So it's a three-dimensional manifold. And so at zeroth order, the sort of relevant field is the metric, HAB. So I plus really is Euclidean ADS3 in that sense, and we can define tensor fields that will be acted on with derivative operators compatible with this metric and have their indices raised and lowered by this metric and so on. And so what's appearing here at first order is this sigma thing and this KAB thing. So this sigma is going to end up being like the Bondi mass aspect. It's going to encode energy and momentum. This K has to do with gravitational memory. Happy to talk more about it after the talk. It's a really nice story. But for now, let's just say those are there at first order. And then at second order, we absolutely have to go there because we want to get angular momentum as well. So here, it's determined by sigma. But I'm going to count logs as order one just for bookkeeping. So we have this IAB. And this JAB. And these are needed for the angular momentum or the full BMS group, really. Okay. All right. So to get some intuition for what these look like, let's do the Schwarzschild metric. Okay, so let's put the Schwarzschild metric in Beig-Schmidt form. Not going to do it live. Yeah.
So this JAB term is 1 over
tau squared, yeah.
Times smaller than the KAB term, but yet it's just one order higher.
Oh, did I mess up the parentheses? Sorry. So KAB is 1 over tau. This is 1 over tau squared. This is log tau over tau. Yeah, guys, if you noticed this stuff earlier, just tell me, because someone else is confused too if I fail to close a parenthesis. So yeah, it's just a 1 over tau expansion, and every once in a while you have to put a log in because nature's annoying like that and puts logs in. Yeah?
I have a question. Did you check the stability of the gauge under the equation of motion?
Under the equation of motion? Stability? I mean, you can use the equations of motion and the gauge freedom to show that this. You can always put it in this form.
right? So for instance, the, let just to make sure I follow the sigma square over tau square term.
Yeah.
Over there, so that's the fact that that's the sigma square is forced by the equations of motion.
Yeah.
At that order in tau.
Yeah. And the gauge choices. I mean, it's hard to tell which is real equation of motion and which is gauge, but you know, you're using both of them. Gauge is part of the equation of motion, right? Pure gauge is the solution to the equations of motion. So the answer is yes. I think I complicated it by. Okay. Podium is in the way. That's interesting. Brilliant. It's on wheels. Whoops. Now it's in your way. It's coming. Okay. Now it's in the TV's way. Okay. Move it again when we need the TV. All right, excellent. So let's get some intuition for these things. And this gets pretty interesting, even though they're simple calculations. Let's do the Schwarzschild metric as our second example. Our first example of an asymptotically flat space-time was flat space-time. Now let's do the Schwarzschild metric. So it's some work. You have to put it in this form. It's surprisingly complicated even for the Schwarzschild metric, but you do it. And let me just show you what sigma looks like at the end of the day. So minus m, 1 over sinh rho minus 2e to the minus rho. And you can also find a gauge where kab equals 0. We put in parentheses because there's some subtleties here that matter for memory. If I try to describe them, I'll get too many questions. So I'll wait until you beg me to talk about that. But let's look at sigma. So this is, you know, of course, sigma, it's not unique. You can still make, there's residual coordinate freedom in this framework. And in fact, part of looking at Schwarzschild is to help us motivate further assumptions to put on this so that our residual coordinate freedom is exactly the BMS group, which is what we want, based on the idea that that's the physical asymptotic symmetry group. But anyway, this is a simple sigma you get out after putting it in Beig-Schmidt form. And let me point out a couple properties. So we've chosen this sigma so that sigma goes to 0 as rho goes to infinity. So that's here, the corner that was being asked about. So it's falling off. That's nice. Not all sigmas do. But we've managed in this, having done this, we've chosen one with that property. And the other thing you may notice is that it blows up at the origin. Sigma blows up at rho equals 0. So that's kind of interesting. We started with a Schwarzschild black hole, which had an event horizon. But we took this limit where we're running away from the event horizon as fast as possible. Right? Any non-zero value of rho corresponds to a non-zero velocity. But the event horizon Schwarzschild is just sitting there. So it goes away, and it's replaced with a pole. So the fact that the Schwarzschild black hole had zero velocity in the usual coordinates, when you take this limit, is replaced by sigma having a pole at the corresponding rapidity.
Could you draw what you're covering from the black hole perspective? If you drew the conformal diagram of the black hole, where do you put I plus there and what do you cover in your coordinates? Only the exterior to the horizon.
I think the conformal diagram for the black hole.
Plus is the,
let me not draw a conformal diagram. If you force me, I will, but let me draw something like this. So if this is the event horizon or something in radial coordinates, okay, then what we're doing is we're asymptotically at large distance from the event horizon, building these hyperbolic slices in the asymptotically flat region. Yeah, we only work at large tau in these coordinates. And if you look at how tau, I mean, this is the flat space-time relationship, but in, you know, Schwarzschild, it's similar, and you see that large tau is going to correspond to large distance either in R or in T. Well, in both, really. It's going to collapse. You see, the way this works is you sort of have bigger and bigger hyperbolas, but the limit you take is like this. And so unless you started, unless you did exactly, so the whole, every point with all these points all these vertical lines outside the horizon, they limit to the single point rho equals zero. And so, in particular, the event horizon does. So everything with zero velocity in the space-time ends up at rho equals zero. And so the fact that we got a pole there is telling us that there was something massive in the space-time with zero velocity. Does that help? I mean, because that is a key idea, and I think a very nice one for, you know, everybody believes you can use point particles to describe, you know, these bodies when they're far apart. Well, you actually see it come out very naturally here. And it's not that the body is being shrunk to zero size. It's that you're rescaling your hyperboloid. The tau equals constant slices are bigger and bigger, but you're describing it on this rescaled unit hyperboloid. So you're effectively reckoning distances with a factor of tau to the minus 2, and the black hole becomes point-like.
So nothing about that would change if you replace the black hole by something?
By a star. Yeah, absolutely. So my belief, and this is going to motivate the assumptions I'm going to make, you know, for what I mean by a scattering space-time, my belief is that this pole showing up in sigma is the good definition of an incoming body. Abstract away from the Schwarzschild metric, and the pole could be at some non-zero value of rho, theta, and phi if the black hole were moving asymptotically. So you can make this nicer mathematics. You can show that the Schwarzschild metric satisfies the equation. So if d is the derivative on I plus, it satisfies the equation. I think there's a 4 pi delta function phi a over some metric determinant to make it covariant. So you can show that this actually satisfies this equation. And so in a very nice sense, the remnant of the black hole at future time-like infinity is just a point source for the field sigma, which is the first order field on I plus.
So if you boost the Schwarzschild metric.
Yeah. Exactly. So what I'm going to assume then, in general, assumption for a general asymptotically flat space-time is that this sigma field satisfies a sum, I equals 1 to n minus, or n plus, the number of outgoing bodies in this case, 4 pi mass of n delta of phi a minus phi a n, the, you know, velocity of the nth body. So if you boost, it turns out the boost acts strictly on this hyperboloid. The loose killing field is tangent to these hyperboloids. So all we have to do is change the value of phi where the delta function is. That's what it ends up being.
So you have checked the boost metric indeed satisfied?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's trivial because the boost is a valid symmetry on I zero. It's just, you just write it with minus phi n.
So isn't the rescaled mass? Is not the boost just the rescaled mass?
When we define the energy, we'll define the mass aspect. If you look at the sigma at large rho, it's going to match with the Bondi mass aspect and give you exactly the formula that Bondi wrote down. Yeah.
Yes. So sorry. Is that MN going to be like the gamma times the
Schwarzschild? Yeah, that's my question.
It's determined in a. It's annoying to write a formula, but the point is, if you have a velocity. It's moving, a particle is moving with speed v in the theta phi direction, there's a unique choice of rho theta phi that corresponds to it. And so you pick that rho theta phi, and that's where you put the point source. M is the mass. No, M is, it turns out to be the invariant mass. Yeah, rest mass. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so I did prepare a picture of this. This is sort of the way you're supposed to think about it. When you have more than one body, these fat, finite-sized bodies get reckoned on the shrunk hyperboloid as point insertions, and this is what we're going to assume for a general scattering space-time. Okay. So now you have to do a lot of work and go through the whole asymptotic symmetry group rigmarole. Given the hour, I'm not going to try to explain that. I'm just going to say we got a lot of it from analytically continuing at spatial infinity, and we did some more of it ourselves to complete it. And at the end of the day, you get definitions, you get the notion of asymptotic symmetry. Some vector field C mu, where when you make an infinitesimal coordinate change, it preserves the Beig-Schmidt form. These vector fields are fully gauged fixed, and it's the BMS algebra, and there's charges associated with every vector field.
Can you write them? Can you write the superrotations?
Yeah, they're all there. Not superrotations.
Is Trinka one? I mean, okay. One.
No, this is all at time-like infinity.
BMS algebra, is it?
Yes, it's the standard BMS algebra. I mean, we carefully added some additional assumptions I didn't tell you about because I don't have time, so that we get exactly BMS algebra. And the justification of that is our ultimate goal is to have one BMS group on the whole space-time. So we need BMS here, BMS here, 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 and here. And then I, you know, have used up most of the time already, so I won't, yeah.
Could you write them at iPros? I mean, it's just a...
Can I write the charges or the vectors?
Yeah.
I'll copy them down. Let's put them way over there.
I don't think the camera can see that.
Well. Okay, let's do it that way. Let's look at some of the vectors. Okay. To find them, see.
Just maybe also the geometry, because BMS is kind of very natural for an null surface, so somehow, you know, there should be a natural geometric ID how you go from this null translation, then you can look. But maybe if you're
It's not that natural to me. Maybe when you see them, you will. So the way we parameterize them. Okay, so this one's easy. So here's the tau coordinate. I have to define all these things. Omega minus 1 over tau. Sigma omega plus dA. Sigma dA. Omega plus you can go as high order as you want. It's a fully gauge fixed thing, but this is, so sigma is the field. Now omega is your representation of the supertranslation. Yeah. So
you're talking about maybe the dominant term, not the one over term. What is your general, the BMS vector?
Then they look just like.
What is the BMS you pull back on iPads?
So just this term. So this is your angle dependent time translation or whatever. And then what the space does, I mean, I'm figuring this out with you. I haven't made a picture of them. So let me not include the rotations and boosts. Yeah, I would love to. The only thing I can say definitively about them is, they are uniquely in one-to-one correspondence with the BMS supertranslation. So a choice of supertranslation at scry at late times fixes this freedom exactly.
You must have done extra conditions, or maybe you can tell us, if you leave at scry, forget the talk, right? What is the kind of condition that allow you to restrict to just the supertranslation?
Oh, we don't. We have the whole BMS group.
Just the whole BMS. I mean, it's like on null, there's a canonical way to get BMS on any null surface.
Any null surface?
Yes.
Okay, sort of most standard set of, Flanagan and Nichols have a long paper. I mean, we used basically exactly the same fall-off conditions they used for their BMS. I mean, I don't think there's too much controversy about the symmetry group of null.
Your extra gauge condition.
Here or at null infinity?
Here.
Okay, here. So we have trace of A equals 0, trace of K equals 0. And furthermore, there's a kind of no magnetic vial assumption. We motivate it from Schwarzschild. Our attitude is it's a consequence of this type of thing. But just to write it down, it has to come from a scalar. I think this is right. So this is the kind of analog of the electric potential for the Bondi shear. KAB, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's it for...
two conditions, just you look at the fixes, the BMS.
And this as well, actually. If you don't do this, you get logarithmic translations, which you could keep because they have trivial charges. Well, at least it's spatial. You can see how quickly this becomes very technical. So we'll cut this off soon and talk more. This kills the logarithmic translations, and then you get down to BMS. You could set KAB to zero entirely, and you would get Poincaré. And you might say, what a great success. We got the Poincaré group, right? That's what we all wanted, at least in 1960. It would be for the restricted set of solutions where KAB is zero. You can absolutely get the Poincaré group at I+. The problem is it won't match to the BMS group at Scry. And you can go back to here and keep matching, but as soon as you have radiation, now the change in Bondi shear is a gauge invariant thing you have to match to. And so it really would fail. If we tried to get Poincaré here, we would not be able to get Poincaré over the whole space-time. So that's the... it's not a problem. I want BMS. I'm just making a point. No, I'm happy. BMS to me is very physical. I mean, the super translations really are the actual physical, you know, spatial and temporal translations you have to make on the LIGO detectors to get them back in their original positions after a wave has passed. They are the memory effect. They're very physical. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I ask you, in the assumption you made there?
Yeah.
What happens to the rho collinear limit? It looks like it blows up.
When you send in two particles one after another with the same...
with the same rho?
Yeah.
It shouldn't, right? Because they have the same velocity, but they're...
So here's my interpretation. I'm so glad you asked that. So there's a big difference between Scry, where you're allowed to send in particles one after another because somehow time on Scry is a thing, and I+, where it appears you're not allowed to send in particles one after another with the same velocity because they all end up here, right? And you get some weird behavior. So my interpretation is, okay, in the massive case, suppose you try to send in a train of particles with the same velocity or send out. Okay, boost into the frame where they're all at rest. What's going to happen? They're going to attract and clump. It's somehow not possible in full nonlinear GR to actually send in particles with the same asymptotic velocity. Whereas with light, you can do that. Light doesn't self-interact in that way. You don't like it? I was really bothered by that until actually the student Hongji came up with this interpretation, and that convinces me. But
I would say that they could have the same velocity, but they would still hit at different angles, right?
No, the angle is the velocity, the full velocity. You can have them at the same speed. That's not a problem. You just mean the same speed, different directions. That's not singular at all. This is three coordinates here, this phi n.
Right. One of the coordinates you're using is rho.
Yeah, rho is the speed.
So if they have the same speed, but they are at a different point, there is a delta zero there.
No, 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 no. No.
What do you mean by this delta? I'm not understanding perhaps the
math. It's the
function of phi.
I mean, it's I should put this in. It's just the invariant delta function. Yeah, but in funny coordinates, and the determinant takes care of the stuff you're worried about. Like, it's not.
So this is a product of three delta. If one delta is zero, that's infinite, right? If
look.
So you can have different theta and phi.
That, in flat space-time, you would have the same issue. If you tried to have a particle at different y and z, but the same x, you would claim delta 3x is infinite. I mean, it's not the way it works. Deltas,
that makes sense, because that's a position.
It's a distributions are maps from test functions to numbers. You have to think they're all integrated over three dimensions in this case. The integral is fine. In that case, you can never evaluate a delta function at its point. It's infinite there, right? At the point where it's infinite. It's always a distribution. And you can definitely multiply delta x and delta of y. That's a valid distribution. We can talk more after if you're not happy about it. But
can I ask another question?
Yeah.
At the level of, it's related to what Laurent mentioned about the gauge fixing, but I'm confused about your notion of gauge fixing. So when I read the gauge up above, I used the three different morphisms to get there because I get the d phi a d tau equal to zero. So I don't have cross term between d tau and defined the matrix.
Okay.
Three conditions.
Okay.
The fourth one that completely fixed the gauge.
There should be a fork diffeo that you have used to go into that form.
I don't remember. And some of this we imported just by analytically continuing from spatial infinity every way. Anyway, so
okay.
Those details are somewhere, and I'm sure they're correct, but I don't have much insight for you live on the talk.
Because without the fourth one, so did you use a fourth one? Do you remember just that?
I don't. There's so many steps in this that I actually didn't do that I don't.
Without the fourth one. Because
oh, yeah, we did more things, for sure. I mean, in particular, we set the trace of k to 0. That might be it. That might be the answer, but I don't want to take a stand.
So I've been trying to understand how BMS emerges in this specific context. So I think you've explained it, right? So you could have restricted to a smaller group than BMS, that would be Poincaré, but that's too restrictive.
Yeah.
But you could have relaxed the conditions to make it larger than BMS, but you don't need that.
Yeah.
So you just found the sweet spot where
yeah.
You know, the degrees of freedom on I plus matches.
Yeah.
That's right. So it didn't have to be BMS, it's just something that you choose.
Yeah. And you can do that at spatial infinity too, and people had done that for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure at Scry, BMS is correct. I mean, of course, it could be proven wrong, but it seems to be the right thing. So that's why we did it everywhere. Yeah.
Maybe just to point out one thing, there is a work from last year by Jose Figueroa Farrell, Jakob Salzer, and Stefan Proaska, in which they kind of show that time-like infinity, space-like infinity, and null infinity, they all have a Carolian structure as a contraction of the Poincaré algebra.
Oh, I didn't realize that had time-like.
The structure is isomorphic to BMS. There is a sense in which they kind of get BMS as intrinsic and not as a gauge choice from the ball, just a la Ashtekar Hansen. So I can point out the paper later.
It's please.
Mathematical, but
We mentioned something about this Carolian structure, but only at Scry. I didn't know it had been done at I plus. Thank you.
So do we have a... So now you have particles going to Hannah infinities.
Yeah.
So we have a balance law for your KAB because of this math.
For KAB. Okay, so I mean, since it has been about an hour, I should probably just... What? I'm happy to talk for hours, but you know, you should at least give some people a chance to leave. But the balance laws are the main result.
Okay. So,
you know, let me say in words, you know, we've gotten to like the first 20 or so equations of the paper. There's now 400 more, right? So basically, you do the same thing with retarded coordinates to have a Bondi expansion instead of a Baikschmidt expansion. And then you do a coordinate transformation to actually relate the Baikschmidt and the Bondi coordinates. And you pick the coordinate transformation such that the charges all match. This is all a lot of work.
At the corner.
At the corner, yeah. And what that tells you, it's an existence proof. You sort of knew it had to happen, but you know, it's good to really see it. The charges of each body, I didn't even mention, the charges are defined as surface integrals, okay? So you make like a surface integral. It's like Gauss's law. So the mass, the energy, the angular momentum, what we call mass moment, which is time-space angular momentum, it all comes as a surface integral. And then if you do this surface, enclosing all of them, you've shown now that it matches the Bondi charges at u to infinity. So here, q at rho to infinity, you usually prove it equals, okay? And so now you've connected the late time Bondi to the total Baikschmidt. And now you have a Bondi framework which tells you these charges evolve. If radiation comes through, they change. And now there's a match to spatial infinity. You do the same thing. Okay, you show that q at u minus infinity is q at I zero. These are automatically conserved, so you don't need to distinguish. So now q at I zero is equal to q at I minus at v goes to plus infinity. You do the same thing here. Q at v goes to minus infinity equals this thing, you know, q at I minus total. And then at the end of the day.
So you can prove the antipodal match.
Right? Yes. Well, what's antipodal?
Under what condition the antipodal matching is?
Yeah, so the charges match under our long list of assumptions, which I believe are compatible with everything known. And we can show you on the paper or something, rather than taking the time to write them. But under the long list of assumptions, the charges really do match. Now, the antipodal thing was not the charges, but the like the bondy shear, right? So this the Strominger sort of antipodal match was CAB is, we call it upsilon star, the antipodal map, you know, C minus AB. I haven't defined this, but for those who know the bondy shear. So this does hold in our coordinate transformation, but it's kind of a coordinate dependent thing. The charges are the invariant thing. You don't have to pick coordinates.
The charges are not antipodally matched, you say.
The charges just match, but that's like a definition as well. Like the way we set it up is that each charge, I can use a slide, is uniquely identified. Like we represent the charges in a very concrete way. There's formulas for the charges, and they have things like T and Y in them. And these are the things you're supposed to pick. There's one celestial sphere, theta and phi. We don't do this antipodal match of the theta and phi. There's one celestial sphere. And if you want to charge at any of the five infinities, you go find the relevant formula and you plug in these. So under that definition of the charges, we've adjusted everything so that the charges match instead of match antipodally. That's just easier to think about. You want angular momentum to be conserved, not to be in the opposite direction in the future or something. So after all of this, I remember the equation number because I sometimes joke about it. The equation 271 of the paper is conservation of energy. So for each BMS generator, whether it's energy, momentum, angular momentum, whatever, you have that the sum of the final plus the Bondi flux through scry plus is equal to the sum of initial plus the Bondi flux through scry minus. And so that's a main result. And getting back to the motivation, yeah?
Maybe it's a technical question, because you mentioned these log terms, so they enters the I enters the definition of angular momentum?
I is in there, yeah.
It's technical. Why do you need the... Sahu
and Sen told us that there is a sub-leading 1 over U behavior of the Bondi shear at late times, and you look at the equations of motion, it says there must be a log in the Bondi mass aspect, Bondi angular momentum aspect, and the angular momentum aspect log matches to this.
Does it affect the charges?
It affects the individual, I believe it affects the individual charges of each body, but not the total. And there's some comments in this about, in the paper about this difference that we don't understand too well, but we put the comments in there to flag it as an interesting issue. Somehow the total angular momentum is easier to define than the individual. But that's a good segue to, in my mind, the way I came at this project, one of the most useful and exciting things about it to me is that now I can define the final angular momentum and initial angular momentum of individual bodies, right? Because I have these charges and I have conservation laws for them, so I know how to use them. So for example, you know, going back to my original question, you know, how am I going to get the, what do I even mean by impact parameter? Well, I can now define an orbital angular momentum because I have an angular momentum of each body, and I can define a spin angular momentum in an orbital, and, you know, I can write down formulas, but you just basically take all the things you would use in Minkowski spacetime to define these quantities, rewrite them in terms of the invariant charges in Minkowski spacetime, the components of angular momentum and so on, and use that to provide your definition. And now you have a framework where, at least in principle, and we're gonna, our next project is to do this for 2PM scattering. It's quite hard to use the framework, but at least it's a framework where you have a definition, you know how to fix the frame, you know what BMS frame to work, wrong picture. You know what BMS frame to work in at late time because you have this whole framework of matching and everything, and so you can really say what you mean by, for example, the final scattering angle as a function of initial impact parameter. And I guess I'll stop there.
Do you get, like, so we've got this notion of angular momentum, and do we also get, like, a notion of mass? Like, is there, like,
well, you get energy and momentum, so from that you can do p squared minus e squared, right? I can flash up my takeaways there.
So now you don't have any ambiguities in the definition?
Well, ambiguity is a funny word. So the angular momentum still transforms non-trivially under supertranslations. But the angular momentum already transforms non-trivially under translations, right? One interesting thing I didn't mention is the spin angular momentum. When you define angular momentum of an individual body, the spin turns out to be supertranslation invariant. When you split up the angular momentum into spin and orbital, the spin piece is supertranslation invariant, which is kind of satisfying because supertranslations are sort of angle-dependent translations, but the body's just at one point. So,
For spin, if you have an impact parameter, for non-spinning impact parameter, is angular momentum divided by p?
Yeah.
But for spin,
that's why I put orbital angular momentum.
Right.
So you have to split it up.
You also have this changes depending on the spin supplementary condition. So.
Nope. I don't know. I've never understood those spin supplementary condition things, but this is about as clean as you could hope for, to be honest. I mean, it's just, here's a nice framework. There's a Lee-Wald approach to finding charges that other people did that I didn't. Here's a nice symmetry group, BMS. Which one should we call angular momentum? How about the one that's a rotation? And that's the charge associated with angular momentum, and then you can just define, you have it for each body, so you can define spin and orbital, and you never need to fuss with these spin supplementary conditions or anything. Of course, it'd be very interesting to connect the frameworks, but you really don't need that in this one.
So when you write this KAV in this form, right, there is a preferred Poincaré group subgroup of your BMS group.
No. This phi is this phi changes under a supertranslation.
I can always do a supertranslation to make it zero.
Yes, but in our framework, if you do a supertranslation here, you have to do the quote-unquote same supertranslation everywhere. So you can make it zero here, or here, but not both. Yeah.
But, I mean, if I just want to look at I plus.
Yes, then you can have a Poincaré group. Absolutely, yeah.
And so you could use that to define.
Well, it's a different preferred Poincaré group from I minus.
Memory effect, right? That's
okay, but I just wouldn't say they're preferred. I would look, when you set up your scattering problem, you usually make various conditions, like center of mass frame. So I think KAB equals zero in the distant past is a nice condition to define your frame. But it just means in the future it won't be because of the memory effect. So that's why you need it in the formalism.
Yeah, so that just means that the preferred Poincaré groups in past and future are different. That's fine.
Okay.
Right. I mean, if you wanted to, so all of this, of course, is important. If you wanted to do the evolution, if your goal was to give a simpler, a simple description of what happens at the final time, then you probably would want to make more restrictive choices to simplify the description.
Yeah, but I would kind of respond that what good is just the final time? You can make anything you want at the final time. What's interesting is the dynamics that gave rise to it. Then you have to compare initial and final, and then you need the global BMS group.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of, suppose that at I plus you have, five black holes that are rotating in, in which way, and you would want to give a clean description as to what each angular momentum is.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe for that, you would want to simplify the metric as much as you can.
Yeah, so you could choose KAB equals zero. That could be your good cut or whatever, I think, is the term that originated at Scry.
Does this mean anything for, most simulations we do aren't reaching out to all of these different infinities at once?
Well, I mean, you sort of are. You're not getting to any of them, but if you're doing scattering where the black holes come in, you certainly start them with initial data where they're pretty far apart and moving at some velocity. So I do think in principle this framework could help, compare different numerical calculations in different gauges, but in practice I think it's not needed now and would be very hard. I think it's easier to use this in analytical calculations where you have the exact answer. But I do hope to do that. I hope in 6 months' time, you know, I'll have used this to help resolve this annoying angular momentum thing in post-Minkowski scattering that's been driving me crazy.
Doing this because your calculations for fluxes at infinity were different to someone else's?
Yeah.
Or at null infinity?
Well, other people computed the flux of angular momentum through Scry, and we computed the final angular momentum of the bodies. They had a nice definition. We didn't have anything. We just computed it. And now I at least have a formula, you know, I guess it's not up, that says two things should agree. But it turns out the charges are so hard to compute. These Beig-Schmidt charges are a nightmare. Because you have to go one order higher in the expansion to get them, because you're reading the charge off of the gravitational field. So even the body sitting there, you have to go to order m to get its charge. So in the end, we may just use the theorem to assert that if we had computed them, they might. But yeah.
Order in
what? Postman G, big G, the post-Minkowski expansion, yeah.